Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the similar taste that Trump and his former friend Jeffrey Epstein have in very young women following Trump's denial today of his close relationship with the accused sex trafficker at the same time as he hedged on his ritual praise of his Labor secretary, who is doing such a great job. The same Alex Acosta who made the sweetheart deal to get Epstein off on a slew of charges in Florida for sexual assault and sex trafficking of minors. Nina Burley, national politics correspondent at Newsweek, whose latest book is Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women, joins us to discuss how many rich and powerful men are sweating at the moment since the Fed seized so much incriminating evidence in their raid on Epstein's Manhattan mansion, which might contain blackmail material Epstein was keeping on his rich friends after they availed themselves of the girls and young women Epstein was offering up to them for sex. With Bill Clinton denying that he'd ever been to Epstein's private island and had only used his private jet for humanitarian trips to Asia and Africa, and Trump stressing that he, quote, wasn't a fan of Epstein despite having been a frequent visitor to his Manhattan home, we will assess whether Epstein will rat out his powerful friends and make a plea deal to lessen a very long prison sentence he is facing, or will all of the sordid details come out in open court where the young girls, now grown women, will have their chance at justice that was delayed, no longer denied. Then we'll examine why Attorney General Barr reversed himself today after having recused himself yesterday from the Epstein case, and whether, since Barr is now acting as Trump's personal attorney, he will make sure that the president is not embroiled in the looming child sex scandal coming to light. Bill Yeomans, a professor of law at Columbia Law School who served 26 years in the Department of Justice, including as acting assistant attorney general, joins us to discuss this and whether Barr, acting on Trump's orders, can find a way to get the citizenship question back on the census in spite of the Supreme Court's recent ruling against Trump. Then finally, we'll look into the formation of a new Human Rights Commission at the State Department by the Secretary of State, which Pompeo has stacked with religious conservatives headed by a zealous anti-abortion activist with the apparent intention to shift the U.S.'s focus from traditional concerns about human rights violations and regimes that engage in human rights abuses to narrow the focus to so-called religious freedom and to oppose gay rights on the basis of traditional family values. Robert Baczynski, Senior Vice President for Policy at Human Rights First, who served in the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, joins us. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Nina Burley, who's the national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her book, The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, was a New York Times bestseller. And her latest book is Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Burley.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So Julie Brown, the Miami Herald investigative reporter who broke the Epstein story of how the sweetheart deal was negotiated with the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of Florida, now the Secretary of Labor, Acosta, she said on Sunday on MSNBC that there are probably quite a few important people, powerful people, who are sweating it out right now. Do you think in terms of what Epstein knows and what he might say, particularly if he goes to trial in open court, do you think one of the people sweating it out might be Donald Trump?
Yes, I do think so, because I think that he spent more time with Epstein than he is letting on at this point in time. My sources say that he interacted with him a lot more than just one or two visits. In fact, I think it's been reported that even after Epstein was arrested the first time, Trump dined with him at his mansion. So, yeah, there's a long history there. And we know from the sources that I've got and other people who have talked, both women and men, that Donald Trump's habit, really, during the 90s and early 00s, was to belong to this club that, you know, this unofficial club of wealthy men who moved these young women around in herds. That's why they had modeling agencies. That's what they used their modeling agencies for. They would have young women coming into New York and competing in things like the Look of the Year contest. I've got a source who's got photographs of him leering at what are clearly underage girls. He's made jokes about it. Those underage girls, those teen Miss Teen America contestants, have described his, you know, wanderings through their dressing rooms, and, you know, they're half dressed in their dressing rooms. He's given them unwanted kisses. The winners would often be given a dwelling in Trump Tower. We know that at least a few of them lived in, he put them up in Trump Tower. So, you know, I think that his predilection, and he certainly wasn't alone in it, in New York City at that time, there were these older guys with lots of money. The media would call them modelizers, guys who just like to hang around with models. And a lot of the models, or the aspiring models, were either these girls coming over from Eastern Europe, looking for husbands, looking for work, looking for money, or just, you know, all American corn-fed girls who were coming here in the hope of getting noticed and made into superstars. And he was one of the arbiters.
Well, according to Trump biographer Tim O'Brien, he actually went with Trump when Trump bought Miss Teen America, the pageant, and was with him when he was doing what you're describing. And he describes it exactly as you say, that he was leering and kissing the girls. And so it sounds like, to some extent, Trump has the same tastes in women as Epstein. Maybe not the same activities, but certainly the same tastes.
Yeah, I think you could surmise that, certainly. I mean, I don't know that he had the predatory appetite that Epstein is alleged to have had, involving, you know, numerous underage girls trafficked in and out of his properties. But certainly Trump liked to be around those girls. And certainly my sources say that he was, as one of them put it, he treated them as sexual snacks.
Well, there are, of course, a trove of DVDs and photographs in the hundreds and even thousands that were seized from Epstein's townhouse, which is apparently one of the biggest in Manhattan, on Saturday. So I guess we'll wait and see. Do you think there's any chance, Nina Burley, that Epstein will avoid a public trial, will try and make a deal? Because one of the speculations is, and it comes from one of the young women, girls, who was a victim, now, of course, an adult, said that Epstein taped a lot of these activities for these young girls, or had them tell him what they did with these rich and powerful men as a form of blackmail. So could it be that the safe full of Epstein's DVDs and photographs were also meant as blackmail material, and therefore, again, a lot of people could be nervous? And do you think he's likely to flip and make a deal? He is facing 45 years in jail, is he not?
Yeah, I don't know. You probably are up on the latest number. I don't know what the years in jail are that he's facing, but certainly this is somebody who has, you know, a legion of the best paid and most connected lawyers in the country working for him. That's how he got away with the slap on the wrist in Florida, the outrageous plea deal that our Secretary of Labor cut for him so that he could have his time in jail was minimal, and he's now back on the private jet flying between France and, I mean, that's where they caught him, at Teterboro. They arrested him the other night at the private, getting off of his private plane coming back from France. He has an apartment in Paris. But, you know, as to what's in that trove, I mean, that goes to the question that a lot of us are asking and have been asking for a while about Epstein's role and what he was doing and why he had these large numbers of young girls sort of coming through his properties. And if their stories are to be believed, you know, they were almost being trained by Epstein and by this woman, Ghislaine Maxwell, who was Robert Maxwell's daughter. Robert Maxwell, this notorious kind of global shadowy figure, media mogul who died mysteriously in, I believe, the 90s, and who was very connected to the Mossad and various kind of underworld, let's say, spy type outfits, you know, the underworld that he existed in. And so the fact that then his daughter comes to New York and suddenly shows up in these situations that these girls are describing as the kind of procurer slash trainer of a legion of young girls who were being moved around on private planes with very powerful men. And you have to wonder, what were they doing? Why were they moving these girls around? What were they training them for? And what's up with all of the photographs and the video? It's certainly, all of it is, if he does have these men on video or in photographs, sure, it's all blackmail. And, you know, my theory, having worked on this book, Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women, is that almost every relationship in Trump's inner circle and in his, you know, the circles around him, almost everyone relies on a kind of actual or implied blackmail. He's always looking for dirt on people and collecting it and sharing it with, you know, David Pecker at the National Enquirer. You know, we know that they were feeding the National Enquirer stories when they wanted to. And you see this sort of tendency towards blackmail kind of metastasizing around him, even into the political culture, so that, for example, when Michael Cohen was going to testify before the his second testimony after he had been convicted up here in New York, he went down to Washington and gave testimony again at one of the congressional committees that famous day where he basically ratted out his former boss in every possible way. And before he came to testify, you had the Florida congressman, Matt Gaetz, tweeting at him, threatening blackmail, basically saying, you know, referring to his wife's affairs or his father-in-law's alleged criminal business dealings. So blackmail is really the thread, the skein that connects all of these people in this underworld. And I think that the feds, as they go through all this material and, you know, will start to come across this material. And the question is, because all of these people have these incredibly high paid and well-connected lawyers, a lot of these lawyers used to work for the Justice Department, you know, I mean, federal prosecutors then go into defense work, right? And they start to work for these guys who are accused and who have a lot of money. So I think what you're going to see, and what you already are seeing actually in the New York court system, the federal court in New York, is that there are all these John Doe's, nameless men, I assume, who are already in the courts with lawyers trying to keep material out of the public eye related to a defamation case that Ghislaine Maxwell, the alleged procuress for Epstein, filed against one of the accusers, one of the girls, now one woman, filed a defamation case against Ghislaine Maxwell because Maxwell was denying her story. And that case has 2,000 pages of documents in it. And Ghislaine Maxwell lost. Ghislaine Maxwell is known to have paid some millions of dollars to this victim that she defamed, or that she was accused of defaming. So those documents have just been ordered to be released by the appellate court in New York. This happened in a few days before Epstein was arrested. An appellate court in New York overturned a lower court ruling that said to these men, no, you're not going to be able to keep this material secret. It's going to be open to the public. So they're already in court trying to keep this stuff down. Right. And it's kind of like a game of whack-a-mole now, sure, because now the Epstein material is going to come along, and they're going to have more lawyers in more courts. And, you know, it's full employment for these white shoe law firms who represent these guys.
Right.
And it could go on for a long time. I mean, their MO,
right.
Trump's MO certainly, is to carry on these cases, even if they're not winnable, which is what he did to Tim O'Brien in his libel suit. They carry them on for years until you practically forget what the underlying issue is.
Right, and the young woman involved, who's 16-year-old Virginia Roberts, worked as a spa attendant.
No, they'll be 60 years old before they see
justice. Yeah, and she was the one that Maxwell has lost the case against. One of the men, of course, named is Alan Dershowitz, who ended up defending Epstein along with the special prosecutor. God, I can't think of his name now.
Starr.
Kenneth Starr.
How soon we forget, you see, because time passes and you can't remember. You know, Ken Starr, the star chamber prosecutor of Bill Clinton,
right,
and the blue stained dress,
right,
and now he's representing, of all people, a known pedophile.
Well, just in closing, the president said today that I knew Epstein like everybody in Palm Beach knew him, but I had a falling out with him a long time ago. I don't think I've spoken to him in 15 years. I wasn't a fan. That's the latest from Trump. On the other hand, Bill Clinton has sent out a press release saying that he only was on the plane, which was called the Lolita Express, Epstein's plane, four times to Europe, Asia, and twice to Africa with Kevin Spacey and Chris Tucker. And he's saying he's never been to the island, little St. James Island. So, obviously, Trump, he likes to equate everything with Clinton's, whether it's Hillary Clinton, and Bill Clinton is a kind of a gift to Trump if he's trying to dodge this bullet. But at the end of the day, just in the last minute, do you think that, one, Epstein can dodge the bullet, or two, if it's proven that there are links to Trump, he can dodge the bullet?
Well, I mean, Epstein's not going to dodge the bullet. He's going to go down. I think the feds, somebody there grew a sense of shame, and they went after him. And you could see that in the press conference yesterday. They're serious, and he's not going to get away. But whether he spills the beans, as you say, or, they already have the material that they've taken out of his safe. Whether somebody comes up and hands off the black book and all of these names come through and are made public, and then Donald Trump's, I mean, it all depends on these girls and whether they are going to come forward and how afraid they are. I mean, you do remember that there's a woman who claims a 13-year-old, whether she was 13 years old, that she was raped by Donald Trump. That person was going to be brought forward by Lisa Bloom in a press conference right before the election in 2016, and she backed out because of death threats. Now, how many other women are sitting out there remembering men that they were introduced to on these planes or on this private island or in the mansion here in New York or down in Florida? How many other women have memories of being abused and used and trafficked when they were young, homeless, hungry? And how many of them are going to talk? And that's the question. And whether or not they get their day in court and whether or not they actually name names, I mean, that's the question. I think that the feds are going to try to give them their day in court. It's, you know, they put up that 1-800 number yesterday. Call us if you've had any interaction with this man. Maybe they'll start coming out of the woodwork. Maybe the 13-year-old, now adult woman, who says Trump raped her, will come forward. But, that's what the golden handcuffs are for the women that Trump interacts with. He keeps them quiet by, you know, money and threats of blackmail. And for these other women who aren't anywhere near as prominent and wealthy as the women around him, the wives, the ex-wives, the daughter, who know things and who would never think of ratting him out because they've got the golden handcuffs. These other people have, you know, everything to lose by coming forward. They probably, you know, the way that they've kept them quiet for so long is by picking them off one by one and saying, here, how much money is it going to take me to make you go away? Do you need college fund? You know, you need money for your kid's college? Do you need a house? You know, everyone has a price. That's how these men think, and that's how they've operated, and that's how they've won.
Well, Nina Burley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
And again, I mean,
take care.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Nina Burley, national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her book, The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, was a New York Times bestseller. And her latest book is Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining why Attorney General Barr reversed himself today after having recused himself yesterday from the Epstein case.
Nothing but a dirty, dirty old man. You do your thinking with a one-track mind. Keep talking about heaven, glory, but on your face is a different story. Clean up your rap, your story's getting dusty. Wash out your mouth, your lies are getting rusty. Can't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Bill Yeomans, who's a professor of law at Columbia Law School, who previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law. He also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice, serving in a series of management positions, including acting assistant attorney general. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Yeomans.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Bill. And I wanted to talk to you, obviously, about the Attorney General, William Barr, now apparently looking for ways to overturn the Supreme Court decision on the question of citizenship in the census, which the Supreme Court ruled against the Trump administration and their efforts to include this question in the upcoming census forms on the basis that the Trump administration's reasons were contrived, which is a polite way of saying they were lying. But before we get into that and the effect that this turnaround by Barr is having, or by Trump, who Barr is apparently obediently following orders from the president because the president was unhappy with the Supreme Court ruling, it's been confirmed now that William Barr has decided he will not recuse himself after consulting with career ethics officials at the DOJ from overseeing the case that just came up yesterday against Jeffrey Epstein by the Southern District of New York's U.S. attorney. So why would he do that? I mean, he said yesterday, standing next to Lindsey Graham down in South Carolina, that he was recusing himself. But then today he decided to unrecuse himself. What would the motive there be? Could he interfere with this case because it could be radioactive because of what happened down in Florida where co-conspirators were immunized and not named and kept in secret? And we know this guy had powerful friends, so this could be a case that blows wide open all kinds of people in powerful positions who are involved in disgusting behavior.
I think that must be his concern, that it is going to blow up, and maybe he knows about some of the tentacles that the case with which the case may reach out. You know, normally in a criminal prosecution that's brought by the Southern District of New York, the U.S. attorney would be the final word, and it would really be unimportant whether or not the attorney general was recused or not. The very fact that he thinks it's important to determine at this point and to announce whether or not he's recused, I think, is significant. It does suggest that he expects to play some kind of role in this case that you would not normally expect him to play.
Well, lately he is fulfilling the concerns that people have, that he has. Trump said he wanted a Roy Cohn, he wanted a lawyer, not the attorney general being the representative of the people of this country upholding the law, but his personal attorney. That is apparently what's happening here. I mean, it seems manifestly clear that he is acting like Trump's personal attorney. And apparently Trump got upset when he read the New York Times front page story about the Supreme Court ruling on the census matter, saying Trump yields on the census issue. Well, if you use the word yield in Trump's lexicon, he's a man who never loses and never backs down. He obviously had a fit. And then he tweets out that we're going to, you know, we're going to come back and have another bite of the apple. So what's going on here?
Well, you know, obviously, as you said, Trump was not making a decision based on law or an analysis of the Supreme Court's decision. He simply decided that he was not going to lose, as you say. And I think he thinks that this asking the citizenship question is very important. I mean, I think he accepts the wisdom within the Republican Party that it will be very helpful for Republican partisan interests going forward to ask the citizenship question and to suppress Hispanic participation in the census. So he is bent on getting the question in. And Bill Barr obviously is taking his orders directly from the president. You know, the Department of Justice had already announced that they considered the matter closed and that the census would be printed without the question. And then Trump jumped in, and Barr, instead of saying, "No, Mr. President, we have already determined this, the Supreme Court has already spoken, and we have made representations to the court that we cannot do this after June 30th, instead of saying that, he jumped to attention and said, "Yes, sir, Mr. President, we'll make it happen." Well, that is not the Attorney General's job. The Attorney General, of course, is there to implement administration priorities, but he is also there to inform the president about the law, and he is the guardian to make sure that the president acts within the rule of law. And it appears that he is just failing miserably at that task. You know, and one of the problems with the census case is that, you know, the Supreme Court's decision is actually comes down to Chief Justice Roberts, who, it appears, probably changed his position near the end and decided to vote to forbid the question. But what he did first was to decide all the underlying questions. So he determined that it was constitutional to ask the question, and he determined that it fell within the statutory constraints to ask the question. But then he said that the reason that the administration gave was pretextual. And, you know, frankly, it was just a lie. But he put it a little more delicately. But so what Roberts did with that opinion was to clear the field for Trump if he wanted to try again. So what he could have simply said was, well, you know, the administration offered a pretextual reason, and no one would know whether the Supreme Court thought it was constitutional or whether it was statutorily permitted. But Roberts cleared all that away, so it's really a kind of an invitation to Trump to try again. And, you know, we don't know exactly what they're going to do yet, but it appears that it's likely that Trump is going to issue some kind of memorandum, something like an executive order to the Commerce Department, telling it to include the question or to print an addendum including the question. That seems to be a pretty direct defiance of the Supreme Court, except that, you know, Roberts has basically said that if the administration can come up with a decent reason for asking the question, then it is otherwise lawful. It's constitutional and statutorily allowed. So we'll see how this plays out. One of the problems for the administration is that, you know, there is ongoing litigation below that has not been stopped. And in Maryland, for instance, the judge has now opened discovery on the question of whether the question was motivated by race. And is racially discriminatory. So that's going on. So it's going to be very difficult for the administration to get a judicial decision allowing the question to go forward. And so if they go forward, they're going to have to go forward basically in defiance of the courts. And the only way to make it happen is for the administration to get right back to the Supreme Court, to jump over the lower courts again, and to try to get the Chief Justice to reverse himself. That seems very unlikely to me, but we'll see how it plays out.
So if he comes up with an executive order to the Commerce Department with a less contrived reason of why they need to put this question on the census, and it's clearly something that they really want to do, and there are reasons for it because it will give Republicans a lot of advantage going forward, as the gerrymandering case has given them enormous advantages going forward in terms of voter suppression and making it much more harder for Democrats to vote than making it easier for Republicans to vote, to get their people out. And the census question will clearly help in that regard by reducing the number of safe Democratic seats, etc. And also it will have an impact on federal funds that go to minority communities. So it's pretty clear what the politics are. So just to sum up on that, what you were just saying then, Bill Yeomans, in other words, if he goes ahead with Barr's connivance and whatever, he comes up with a better excuse, or at least one that doesn't look so flagrantly racist. Then it's up to Roberts. If he can jump across the appeals court, go straight to Roberts, he then, what does he do? Just has another vote?
Well, you know, they have to petition the court, and they have to, you know, get the court to take the case. And in doing that, they'll have to present the question to be decided. And as you correctly point out, they'll have to come up with something that's better than the explanation they gave. You know, the original explanation was that the government needed this information to enforce the Voting Rights Act. Well, that was nonsense. I filed a brief along with five other former heads of the Civil Rights Division in the Justice Department, the division that administers, that enforces the Voting Rights Act. And we all said, in our tenure, we had never needed this information through the census, that there are alternative sources that are better. So that was nonsense. And then, you know, the Hofeller information came out. You know, he is the Republican strategist who seems to have originally come up with this notion of the citizenship question. And his reasons for asking the question were overtly racist, to suppress Hispanic votes. So I think it's going to be almost impossible to overcome all of that and to come up with a new reason. I mean, what does the administration say now? Well, we didn't really mean it when we said the Voting Rights Act. What we really meant was this other thing. You know, I think the problem here is the administration, and unfortunately the Department of Justice, is losing credibility in the courts. And, you know, we saw that the Department of Justice is putting up a whole new team of attorneys to litigate the case going forward. And I think part of that is probably because the attorneys who have been working on it in the past feel that they can't go back to the court and contradict things they had said before. For instance, that this had to be concluded by June 30th. And, you know, it may well be that some of them feel some kind of ethical constraints. But I think it's also, you know, the Department of Justice trying to wipe the slate clean and get a fresh start. Because now they can send their lawyers into court and say, well, you know, we didn't raise this before, but that was, you know, these old lawyers. Now we're here. We're the new team. We have thought this through, and here's our reason. But I don't think it's going to fly. It just should not. It's too transparent.
But won't this have long-term damage with the reputation of Justice Department lawyers? My understanding is that over the decades and longer, they've established a sort of trust with the federal bench that if you speak for the government as a DOJ lawyer, you're taken seriously and you have credibility and trust. This seems like, you know, if you get rid of the entire team, and for good reasons, as you pointed out, and you bring in, I think they're coming in from the Consumer Protection Division of the DOJ. They're not even the right kind of lawyers, from what I can tell. Do you think this is going to have some long-term damage with the relationship between the DOJ and the federal bench?
I fear that it might. You know, as you correctly point out, I mean, one of the most important things that the Department of Justice has going for it is its credibility. And I know as a Justice Department lawyer going into court that judges look to the government lawyer to tell them the straight scoop. When there's some dispute about the facts or the record or cases are being cited and whatever, frequently judges will just stop and ask the government attorney what's really going on here. That's an incredibly valuable commodity, both for the Department of Justice, but also for the country, for the people they represent. If that's frittered away, you know, I think it's devastating. We don't want the Department of Justice becoming just another overly zealous advocate for unsupportable positions. You know, the new lawyers, as you point out, come from mostly from a branch of the civil division that has nothing to do with census or anything else. It's consumer protection. But there's also a group of lawyers coming from the Office of Immigration Litigation, an office that's known as OIL. And that raises some kind of suggestion that the new rationale that's going to be forthcoming from the president will have something to do with immigration. And I think that's worth watching and, again, raises concerns that this whole case will become not only part of a sort of attack on democracy, but it also will become part of the president's attack on immigrants. So we will watch this very carefully.
So back to the news today that William Barr, after saying yesterday that he was recusing himself from anything to do with the Epstein case, now before the Southern District of New York, and presumably there's an element. I think the DOJ is actually looking into the deal, the sweetheart deal, that the now Secretary of Labor, Acosta, who was then the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of Florida, made with Epstein, which people are finding appalling. That's apparently, I think, being re-looked at. So if he's now back in looking at the Epstein case and could affect it, there is a connection, of course, directly to William Barr, in as much as Epstein dropped out of the Cooper Union NYU Mathematics Science School and then got a job teaching at the Dalton School in the mid-1970s. And he was hired by, of all people, Attorney General William Barr's father, who hired him in spite of the fact that he didn't have a college degree. And apparently, I think somebody, one of the parents of the kids at the school, recognized how brilliant he was at math and got him into Wall Street. That's my understanding. So there is a connection there already. What kind of, I mean, obviously we'd like to, inquiring minds would like to know, what is the relationship between Epstein and Donald Trump, who visited his Epstein's townhouse in Manhattan on many occasions, according to the doorman next door? And what is the source of Epstein's wealth? Because none of it makes any sense. He only had one client as a money manager, and nobody quite knows where his money comes from. So there's a lot to learn about this guy, is there not? So given Barr's record in trying to bury the Mueller report, you are concerned, I take it, that he could bury some of what might come out in the Epstein investigation, given
the powerful men
that, by the way, Bill Clinton, just to be fair, Bill Clinton has sent out a press release saying that he never went to Epstein's Island. He only went on the plane four times on Clinton Foundation business to Africa and went to his place once with both his Secret Service detail and a staff member. Fox News is saying that he's made endless trips to the island. So I tend to believe Clinton over Fox News. But you can tell already, Bill, that a lot of people are nervous about the associations to Epstein coming out.
I think that's right. I think they're very nervous. And to go back to the recusal question and the fact that DOJ is doing an internal investigation into the original prosecution, that investigation is being done by the Office of Professional Responsibility, which is the office in the Department of Justice that ensures that attorneys comply with the rules of professional responsibility. That office, though, is not independent. It does ultimately answer to the Attorney General. So the normal chain goes up to the Deputy Attorney General, but it can go to the Attorney General if the Attorney General wants to be involved. So that's quite possible that Barr is thinking about the OPR investigation and whether it's going to be necessary for him to step in and play some role in that. That would be unusual and unfortunate. But it's certainly a possibility. I think the other thing that has people very concerned is Alex Acosta, the Secretary of Labor, who was the U.S. Attorney who oversaw the initial inadequate prosecution. And there seems to be some mystery surrounding what happened with that whole incident. And Acosta said in a letter that he wrote several years ago that the defense attorneys were doing probing investigations of prosecutors and looking into their personal lives. And, you know, that was one of the reasons that he gave for the kind of truncated investigation and inadequate outcome. So it may be that there's something more there as well that was going on with Acosta. We just don't know. It's clear that Congress needs to get involved here, needs to conduct hearings to find out what it can find out. It's also clear that people need to keep a careful watch on the Office of Professional Responsibility investigation. One of the problems with OPR investigations is that they can be kept confidential. So, and they also can be very slow. So this could drag on, and it's not clear that we'll know about the outcome when there is one.
Well, Bill Yeomans, it's depressing to think that the chief law enforcement officer of the land is somebody that you simply can't trust. But that's what we have, and I thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Bill Yeomans, who's professor of law at Columbia Law School, who previously taught constitutional law, civil rights, and legislation at American University's Washington College of Law, and also served for 26 years in the Department of Justice, serving in a series of management positions, including acting assistant attorney general. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the formation of a new human rights commission at the State Department by Secretary of State Pompeo. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Rob Bershinsky, who is a Senior Vice President for Policy at Human Rights First, where he oversees the organization's work advancing a U.S. foreign policy rooted in a strong commitment to human rights, universal values, and American ideals. And previously, he served in the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and prior to that, served under Ambassador Samantha Power as Deputy Director of the U.S. Mission to the United Nations Office in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rob Bershinsky.
Great. Well, thanks. Good to be here.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Rob. And Secretary of State announced on Monday that he was setting up a human rights advisory panel in the State Department, and he said it would be grounded in the nation's founding principles and the 1948 United Nations Declaration of, I think it was called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So let's begin with that declaration. I recall that two nations refused to sign the 1948 UN Universal Declaration for Human Rights. They were South Africa and Saudi Arabia. And it seems that the Trump administration is particularly fond of the Saudi Arabian prince, and they've gone to enormous lengths to get him off the hook when the whole world is condemning him for having something to do, if not being the author of the assassination of the Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. So excuse me if I'm a little skeptical about this new definition of human rights.
Yes, well, you have, I think, every right to be skeptical, Ian. There are a lot of us in the human rights advocacy community who are quite skeptical of the commission. And there are a number of reasons for that, I think, including the one you've just pointed to in terms of the Trump administration's hypocrisy on many of these issues. But a lot of the skepticism out there revolves around two things. One, how the commission came into being and its makeup. The 10 commissioners were announced yesterday. And then two, what you're alluding to, which is the commission's role in policymaking and its focus, as Secretary Pompeo described yesterday, in the context of an administration that I, among many, feel has been fairly atrocious in terms of protecting and promoting human rights abroad.
So the person that they put in charge is apparently a very zealous supporter of, or opponent, I should say, of abortion. What about the other commissioners? Are they all equally in that kind of category, if you will, of religious conservatives?
Well, I wouldn't say that they're all religious conservatives, but if you look at the 10 commissioners, that's certainly the trend line. People are still looking at the backgrounds of a number of these individuals, but at least half, probably more, come from human rights, either as a religious clergy member or someone who is focused largely as an academic on religious freedom issues. And while there's certainly nothing wrong with that at all, the critique that's emerging is twofold. One is both the chairwoman, as you mentioned, and a number of the commissioners have staked out rather extreme positions with respect to LGBT rights and marriage equality and often reproductive rights. And then also the commission has been billed at least as representing a diversity of views. And while there are no doubt a diversity of individuals on the panel, it's hard to discern a diversity of views on those issues, much less a diversity of expertise in terms of the full panoply of pressing human rights matters that are ongoing in the world.
Now, in terms of Barack Obama, apparently he was the trigger that had Marianne Glendon, who's in charge of this new commission set up by Secretary of State Pompeo. She turned down, I think it was either a job or an award from Notre Dame, because Obama had given a keynote speech there, and she did it because she objected to President Obama's position on abortion rights.
That's right. That's a fairly well-known anecdote in her biography, that in 2009, shortly after Obama came into office, that she refused to accept an award from Notre Dame University and described Obama as an opponent of fundamental principles of justice regarding his position on abortion. So that's one of several statements that have raised eyebrows, to say the least, in terms of her approach to these issues.
Well, she also criticized the decision to nominate the Boston Globe for a Pulitzer Prize for its reporting on the sexual abuse of children by Catholic priests, saying that if fairness and accuracy have anything to do with it, awarding the Pulitzer to the Boston Globe would be like giving the Nobel Peace Prize to Osama bin Laden. Well, there was no question that the Boston Globe had it right, and that was way before the entire sordid story, which is still ongoing, of pedophilia and abuse of children in the Catholic Church. It is a story that won't go away, and there was nothing inaccurate about it. So it's very hard, to my mind, to justify that assessment.
Well, I'm not familiar with that anecdote, so I would hesitate to characterize it. But there's no doubt that Professor Glendon is a very staunch supporter of the Catholic Church, and among other things, has been the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican, to the Holy See.
Right. Well, let's turn to the other objection, apart from abortion, which seems to be a sort of universal thread here in terms of the makeup of this new commission and the priorities that they appear to have. Opposition to LGBT rights, etc. I find that pretty strange, because if you look at history, and particularly the more recent despots who've piled up, you know, millions of corpses, Hitler being, of course, the first one that comes to mind, when they first take over, and particularly in democracies, they go after minorities. In the case of Hitler, they went after the Jews, of course, but they also went after homosexuals. And it would seem to me that preserving and protecting the rights of homosexuals is like it's almost like the canary in the coal mine in terms of human rights, isn't it? Isn't that the early target of despots? And, you know, it's not just Hitler. I could give all kinds of examples, both contemporary and in history.
So the way I'd respond to that, and happy to talk more about gay rights, but just to kind of frame this aspect of how the commission has been described to the American people thus far. As you mentioned at the outset, Secretary Pompeo's remarks yesterday centered on his view that the commission is necessary because there has been, the human rights movement has essentially gone astray since the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776, and that he wants to bring back a focus on the so-called unalienable rights that were referenced in the famous lines following, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." And what's so jarring to many human rights activists within the United States and abroad is that since the signing of the Declaration, we've witnessed roughly 250 years worth of the expansion of rights. And much of that expansion has come following enormous amounts of work and bloodshed and national strife. So the expansion of rights to African Americans and to women and to, most recently, LGBT people, none of whom the founders intended to bestow rights upon in the late 18th century. So it's particularly jarring to hear a body commissioned by the United States government whose express purpose in that government's telling is to contract the very rights that Americans have spent 250 years expanding. And that's certainly true as relates to LGBT people. That does, again, on the basis of the background of the commissioners, seem to be a clear focus of the work to come. It's probably also true of women's reproductive rights, as we were discussing. And it may also be true of so-called economic, cultural, and social rights. So these are issues like education and healthcare. I believe there's a strong argument to be made that societies are better off when we talk about issues like education and healthcare as rights, and then we can fight about how best to procure those public goods. But we see in the rhetoric around this commission an attempt to lay intellectual groundwork to say that marriage equality is not a right as envisioned by the framers, and nor are many of the other benefits of living in an advanced society that people's lives revolve around and that make us all healthier and better educated and lead to more positive lives for all of us.
Well, if Pompeo is a textualist like the conservative judges that the Federalist Society are putting on the Supreme Court, where the literal word of the Constitution is carved in stone and can't be moved in any way and updated according to modern trends and traditions, if you just stick with the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, that we're endowed with inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, well, aren't gay rights the pursuit of happiness? I mean, you can't legislate love, but I mean, it seems to me that the one thing that there's not enough of in family life in this country is, and in the world in general, is, you know, loving families. So I don't see why lesbians, gays can't have loving families and pursue happiness. If you're going to be fundamentalist about the text, I think you can argue back, can't you, against that notion that...
Oh, most certainly. And I personally am not a lawyer or a constitutional scholar, but marriage equality, for one, has been settled in the courts. And so it'll be interesting to see, given that this commission assembles a number of scholars, religious conservative scholars, who have been on the record as opposing marriage equality, among other issues in the basket of LGBT rights. It'll be interesting to see what they have to say about that. If, however, they come out and as somehow providing intellectual cover to restricting rights that have been well established at this point in the U.S. domestic legal context and are well established as a matter of U.S. foreign policy, this commission is going to raise even more of an uproar than it has in the month or so since it was first publicly acknowledged.
So are Pompeo and the others, the religious conservatives on this new commission, I mean, obviously it's difficult to criticize religion and it's probably largely inappropriate. But I think when religion starts to dictate to others, then I think it crosses a line and when it becomes dogmatic. And this feels to me that it's somewhat out of the mainstream of religious tolerance in this country.
And well, I should be clear about that. I mean, there is absolutely nothing wrong with the U.S. government supporting religious liberty both at home and abroad. And as a former diplomat, I spent a decent amount of my time speaking with officials in authoritarian governments about the need to treat any number of minorities on a fair basis, to include religious minorities. So not to imprison religious minorities for their deeply held views. It is entirely the role of the State Department to be engaged in those sorts of actions. I think the real concern here is, as you say, whether these commissioners have views that are, number one, diverse across a broad spectrum of thought in the human rights community. And I think it's pretty self-evident that the commissioners as appointed have failed that test already. And then it's equally important, if this is a commission focused on human rights in the world today and America's approach to these issues, that they be thinking well beyond religious liberty, because that is an important issue, but it's far from the only issue. And I, among many people who follow these issues closely, believe that we are facing a global environment in which fundamental freedoms are under assault from a number of different directions. There are very real issues out there, and the United States having a strong policy on these issues is very important. It just doesn't seem, from the makeup of this commission and how it's been described by Secretary Pompeo, that that's really what it's all about, that that's really what the commissioners are out to do.
But if somebody, a public official like Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence, wear their religion on their sleeve as they do and make no bones about their beliefs, isn't that fair game then for people who can analyze and assess the theocratic basis of their beliefs? For example, both Pompeo and Pence believe in the rapture, and yet they are in charge of our national security at the highest level. And the Middle East could explode at any moment with tensions with Iran, etc. So to my mind, you cannot be a steward of our national security and have an investment in the end of the world. Do you see that as a legitimate argument?
Well, I can't speak to what Secretary Pompeo and the Vice President feel in their hearts. I will let them characterize their own religious views. I think the point here is the Trump administration should rightfully be criticized on any number of issues concerning human rights and fundamental freedom. This is an administration led by a president who routinely attacks the free press guaranteed in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, consistently attacks judges and the rule of law in the United States, has been behind a policy of separating children from their parents at the U.S. southern border, and then denying that he ever did some such thing, is currently embroiled in the fact that those being detained on the southern border are being held in subhuman conditions. The list just goes on and on, has a natural affinity for strongmen and dictators, seems to have much more trouble interacting with the leaders of our closest democratic allies. And then, as you mentioned earlier, both the president and Secretary Pompeo, when they speak about human rights, exercise extreme selectivity. And that's true of every administration to an extent. It was certainly true of the administration that I served in. But this one just seems particularly egregious. And that contrast you draw between policy toward Iran and rhetoric around Iran and policy and rhetoric towards Saudi Arabia just couldn't be more stark, where this is an administration that rightfully, in my opinion, points out the ways in which the Iranian government abuses its own population, but has just gone to extreme lengths to protect Saudi officials who are responsible for the potential starvation of millions in Yemen, are clearly responsible for war crimes in their bombing campaign there, are responsible for the murder of a Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, and so on and so forth. And so my advice to the commission, though I'm not confident that it will be taken up, is to the extent that there is any use in a body like this, it needs to be focused on improving the United States' own record on human rights. And that starts with the secretary that they're advising.
Well, Rob Baczynski, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Rob Baczynski, who's a Senior Vice President for Policy at Human Rights First, where he oversees the organization's work advancing a U.S. foreign policy rooted in a strong commitment to human rights, universal values, and American ideals. And previously, he served in the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, and prior to that, served under Ambassador Samantha Power as Deputy Director of the U.S. Mission to the United Nations Office in Washington, D.C. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.